What is going on, crypto family? Boy, do we have a treat for you today. So I had the honor of hanging out and interviewing the man who got me into crypto. So this is the one and only Max Kaiser. It's a bit embarrassing as the chairs they had us set up in pretty much swallowed me whole, but Max pulled it off. You know, the guy looked like a boss, because, you know, he is. anyways, the chair kind of swallowed me whole. I've got mad respect for Max. You know, this guy, you know, I don't always agree with, you know, what he has to say, but he is right a lot, and he has done a ton for many people just all over the world. He's opened my eyes and many eyes to Bitcoin, you know, back in 2011, you know, that $3-4 range. He knew about it even before that, but that's, you know, when he got my attention. He has his own TV show on RTTV. It's called The Kaiser Report. And he's always bringing up, you know, like stimulating conversation while setting trends. You know, in this interview here, we talk about manipulation, you know, like why Bitcoin is so sexy cool. You know, we talk about how it's here to save us, how even through big bank and government manipulation, he still feels that it's going to survive and thrive. He still thinks that, you know, it's going to go over $100,000. We talk about his favorite movies, you know, books, his advice to people. We even talk about like mushrooms and marijuana, how he invented digital currency. I mean, how he got into crypto, found Bitcoin, and even more. And he's one of my my Bitcoin heroes for sure. And this is a dude that opened my eyes, you know, like 8 years ago to crypto. And so, you know, even though I don't always agree with everything Yoda says, I have a ton of respect and admiration for this guy, you know, and all that he's done for the people, you know, and for the space in general. You know, this guy's wild, he's funny, he's super smart. I let him do like 95% of the talking, as it's just so incredible to hear his thoughts on, you know, all these different things. So, anyways, I hope you enjoy it.
Just a friendly reminder, Crypto Beatles shows are never financial advice, recommendations, or trading strategies. The views expressed here are solely that of Robert Beatles and his guests. Robert Beatles is the co-founder of the Monarch Wallet, host of TradingView Sessions, Crypto Beatles on YouTube, and on several entities. Robert's opinions here do not reflect that of those entities. Some information shared here may not actually be factual. These shows are for information and entertainment purposes only. Never invest a single Satoshi or penny in anything without first seeking the counsel and advice of a professional financial advisor. Robert Beatles is not a financial expert or advisor. Investing in anything is super dangerous. You can lose all of your money, so always trade at your own risk. And one last thing before we get into this, please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the fam. All right.
So without further ado, I give you the one and only Max Kaiser. What is going on, crypto family? So we're with the one and only Max Kaiser. It's an honor, man.
Really, Robert, it's great to be on the podcast, on the show.
Thank you. For, you know, a lot of people, they know that you're actually the guy that got me to look at Bitcoin back in like 2011. You used to come on Alex Jones' channel, and, you know, he would talk about, you know, the world's, you know, kind of ending and falling apart and everything, and you would come on and talk about Bitcoin and how it could basically save the world. So, huge thank you to you. You're one of the few people, you know, that's alive that I respect and look up to. And so, it's great to have you here.
That's right. Alex Jones, 2011, you know, it was a big year to get the word out there. And, you know, there's a lot of people, you mentioned, oh, I'm still alive. You know, that's interesting because a lot of people from that era are crazy. They've gone insane, what I call Bitcoin derangement syndrome. You know, they look too closely at the protocol and it drove them insane. My friend Matthew Mellon, he's dead. I look at people like Roger Ver, I think he's gone crazy. John McAfee, certifiably nuts. You saw that movie Bird Box on, I think it was Netflix?
I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, the premise is if you look at this thing, it forces you to kill yourself, right? So that's the Bitcoin protocol. If you look at it, you stare at it, you'll go insane and want to kill yourself. You got to know what you're doing here. This is dangerous stuff.
You're saying if you like look at the code or if you just look too deep into Bitcoin, people are actually...
You look too closely at the truth. The truth of Bitcoin is that it is... freedom, right? So it's sure. The encapsulation of freedom. It's a distillation of freedom. It's the genesis block of freedom. It's pure freedom. It's freedom that you see talked about in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But it's in its purest form. And if your mind is not ready, can't handle it, it will do a number on your brain.
You know, kind of speaking to that, I mean, why do you think that Bitcoin is so important? Why is it so important to you? I mean, I know why, but maybe for some of the people that are new to the channel, they don't understand the importance of Bitcoin. Now they're like scared of it. They're like, I'm afraid to look at it. I'm going to die. But why is this
not if you're important? If you have an honest soul, you have nothing to worry about. Well, it's I think we're seeing really this whole Bitcoin story play out now with things like the Yellow Vest or Gilets Jaunes movement in France. And this is part of what we've talked about on the Kaiser Report now for 10 years, the global insurrection against banker occupation. Because before Bitcoin came on, we were talking about banks and bank fraud, and we were talking about silver and gold as hard money and how this offers a way to get out of the fiat money system, and the fiat money system is problematic in many ways. And so that is a continuation of that idea that we need to escape the imprisoning qualities of fiat money, and Bitcoin came at the right time. And this global protest movement you see everywhere in the world right now, it's gathering pace. It's really, really happening. You know, when the Gilets Jaunes talk about they want to pull all their money out of the bank, they're making the connection that their problems are associated with banks and central banks. So they understand the connection. And it's only a matter of time now when they see how Bitcoin will be kind of the final act in this play of freedom.
So knowing that the bankers and kind of the central authorities are so terrified of, you know, an outside currency that they're not controlling, right? Because they're used to controlling fiat. Bitcoin is kind of like a peer-to-peer people's coin. Do you ever worry that maybe all the, you know, I guess the transactions we see, all the purchasing of Bitcoin, the way that they've been gobbling it up, do you worry that they're ever trying to like buy up as much of it as they possibly can to control it, keep the price down so that way they can basically make it, you know, worthless of sorts and then introduce something else in its place if they push down everybody's throats?
Well, this opens up a number of different kind of bullet points or topics here. So the idea that the banks are going to try to monopolize Bitcoin by buying it all up, okay, we don't care about that because they're just going to keep forcing the price higher. And it will enrich a lot of people outside of that banking cartel. And it'll mute worthless that banking cartel in a lot of ways. So a second point is that, are they introducing these derivative products, you know, banking derivative products like that we saw with the futures products? And the Bitcoin market topped when they came out with a futures contract in Chicago. And that's probably not a coincidence, right? So there are ways to control what's called price discovery. You know, everything that has a price, that price goes through price discovery. Now you're matching up buyers and sellers, and you're creating a clearing price to satisfy the buyers and the sellers. And there are ways to manipulate that. And so when you have futures contracts and derivatives, it's a way to manipulate that price discovery. So that genuinely is an issue. And Trace Mayer, you know, he's come out with proof of keys. So on. And I was also, I guess, you know, part of bringing that to the forefront, along with Caitlin Long from the Wyoming group that's turning Wyoming into a Bitcoin-friendly state. So that idea is to pull the keys off the market so that it renders the derivatives worthless. So it's a way to fight back. We've seen this in gold and silver, and I had a campaign called Crash JP Morgan Buy Silver. So if you take your silver off the market, they would be forced to cover their shorts in the silver market, and they would go bankrupt. And they were genuinely under some attack there for a while, but then they were able to wiggle their way out of it as they normally do. But the same thing applies to Bitcoin, and so that's the second part of what, you know, my answer to what you're asking about is, are the banks a threat? The third part of the answer has to do with this ongoing hash rate question or debate. You know, does price follow hash rate? Does hash rate follow price? I think it's understood. It's pretty easy to understand how price would follow hash rate. You know, there is an argument to be made that hash rate can sometimes precede price. And that has to do with this whole idea of a 51% attack that's built into the Bitcoin protocol. So it's not a bug, it's a feature. You know, if we want people to attack Bitcoin and try to attack it with a 51% attack. And I think Charlie Lee over, Satoshi Light made his point pretty clearly recently. because that drives hash rate. You know, people are going to want to get a massive hash rate and try to get a 51% attack. We saw Jihan Wu try it, and Bitmain, and Roger Ver, and they failed spectacularly. But it drove the hash rate up to higher, and it drove the economy, and it drives price. I don't think that necessarily it's always the case, but I think you do see this quid pro quo. You do see a kind of a trade-off sometimes where hash rate can actually be driving the price. So that's part of the magic of this protocol. I don't think it's ever going to be duplicated by any other coin. If there's a state coin, you know, a United States coin, a China coin, these coins are never going to do what Bitcoin has done. They can only help feed the need for more Bitcoin because their shortcomings will become obvious. Look what's happening in Venezuela. They came out with the Petro. It was a spectacular failure. The guy who's now the assumptive president is actually pro-Bitcoin. I just was reading about, you know, he made some pro-Bitcoin tweets. So, again, is the protocol, you know, at work stealthily in Venezuela? You know, has it gotten into the heads of people? That's the thing about when I talk about Bitcoin derangement syndrome. It gets into people's heads, and it changes the way they think, and it's changing the course of history.
No, you're absolutely right. It definitely does. I was just speaking with a guy that has a cryptocurrency project in Africa, and they're all pro-Bitcoin. It's basically, you know, kind of changing the landscape, going, you know, merchant to merchant, being able to empower the people to use Bitcoin versus, you know, the fiat currency that they're not able to really use or be able to, you know, take to the bank, or the hyperinflation wipes it out. So, yeah, no, there's definitely you know, some great things with Bitcoin for sure. One of the things that I worry about, though, is just like you were mentioning with the silver and gold is, you know, with these future products and things like that, where they're able to, like, print, you know, all this different, you know, fake gold, right? Fake silver. And then they're kind of doing that, you know, here with Bitcoin, right? So if there's, like, 360x more paper gold certificates than there is gold, couldn't they kind of do the same thing with Bitcoin and then just, you know, kind of further, you know, kind of further crush the price? And because a lot of people in the space right now, they're all just, all they hear about is price, right? They don't, you know, I get that there's a lot of people, you know, talking about adoption, you know, the freedom it brings, but most people right now think crypto's dead. You know, it's like, you know, the price is falling, crypto's dead, why are you still doing this? So what do you kind of think about that?
Well, okay, so to kind of reiterate here, so yeah, the price can be manipulated by what are effectively counterfeit sell orders in the futures markets or in the derivatives market. For every buyer that shows up, you can fabricate 100 sellers. You're counterfeiting sell orders. And that has the reflection of that price discovery that we see as the quoted price. So the price discovery mechanism is fairly mute, you know, just looks at all sell orders and all buy orders, and it creates a price. It doesn't weed out the fake counterfeit sell orders. And so we end up with prices that are manipulated. And this is systemic across all markets. And now we have it in Bitcoin. And the way that, my view is that there's a couple ways that this is going to be effectively fought. One is this proof of keys idea, where all derivative contracts, even those that have multiples of fake orders or rehypothecation, okay, this is the idea of selling the same thing over and over and over again. You're reselling the same thing over and over again. This all basically has a reference price of the asset is still on somebody's books. So in the case of, let's say, an S&P futures or, let's say, a bond futures derivative contract, you know, that bond, that treasury bond exists. It's on somebody's balance sheet. It might have been resold 100 times. It does, in fact, have a journal entry somewhere in the chain. So if you were to remove that bond from the equation, those derivative contracts effectively go to zero because there's nothing there for, at that point, there's nothing that they reference. So in proof of keys, you're taking your keys out of the system. And so you're rendering all those, you're forcing a bank run. All right, you're forcing a bank run, and you don't have that with silver and gold because it's a cash settlement, and it's heavy, that's a big factor, and you know, so with Bitcoin you don't have that issue. Number two, you know, the game theory that's built into the Bitcoin protocol is genius, and it's beautifully balanced, and it's beautifully incentivized. So it's my view is that if you have a central bank or a big bank or a large institutional entity attempt a coordinated global attack on the price of Bitcoin, it would require cooperation by all members to make that work. In the case of gold, they do pull it off because there is a lot of cooperation because it's free money for them. It's free money for them because if they get price of gold to 1500 or 1600, they know that they can all gang up on the price, take it down to 1300 again, and make some easy money. And they all signal each other all day long, and they all scalp the market because there's always a perpetual demand for gold. The demand for gold never goes away. And the central banks are constantly abusing that situation to scalp the market. Now, in the case of Bitcoin, the risk, by the way, is that one of the cartel breaks ranks, and the price of gold jumps to 2,000, 2,500, 3,000, and then they would the cartel, the collusion would be broken, and the price would be free to trade. So you're risking, let's say, $5 or $6 upside to make a guarantee $300 or $400 on the downside, and you can hedge that, and you can pretty much print money by abusing the price of gold. Now, in the case of Bitcoin, it's slightly different because the risk is not $300 or $400 on the upside. The risk is would be $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on the upside. So, if one bank breaks ranks and they say, you know what, we're the bank of X, Y, and Z, and we know all you guys are short, and we're going to go long because we're going to come there for the biggest bank, right? That's game theory. So the game theory is played out. First, on the individual level, we saw some whales, you know, were very instrumental in price discovery. And then it became the pools, mining pools. And then that moved around geographically. It was in Iceland, was a big factor with Bitfury. No, are they in Iceland? No. Bitfury is in Ukraine. And then, or Georgia. Then you had China became huge concentration with Bitmain. Now that's been broken up. So on the minor level, that game theory has worked. So now, in my thoughts, that's going to jump to the state level. So you're going to have a state now try to bully the price of Bitcoin, but that just brings the game theory jumps to a much bigger scale, which means the price goes a lot higher. So this is being played out again and again, but I think, again, the price is part of that Bitcoin derangement syndrome. If you're buying purely as a speculative instrument and you don't know anything about it other than that, you're going to be shaken out easily and you're going to be missing a lot of why you should be in this asset and why it's going to do well over time. I've been a stockbroker in the 1980s, and so I have 35 years in securities business. And this is very common. You know, people get into something because of the volatility. They don't really understand much about it. They get shaken out easily. They're buying, you know, at the top. They're selling at the low. They're getting into a negative spiral. They're shaken out of this industry. They become negative. But they don't. They had no business being there to begin with.
Well, you're absolutely right, for sure. Do you still hold, you know, I guess the thought that it's still going to go to $100,000 and then basically sell at that level? Is that, you know, kind of your train of thought still?
Well, the $100,000 price level first was talked about by me in 2011. And I got the idea pretty much from Rick Falkvinje, who was in Stockholm, and he's a very early adopter into Bitcoin. And I saw him in a presentation in Prague, and you know, he made the case basically that Bitcoin will compete at the central bank level with fiat money. And even if it gets to 1 or 2% of the global Forex market, you know, the global Forex market is $5 trillion a day. It's the biggest market by far. So even to get to 1%, 2% of that market, you're talking $100,000 per Bitcoin. So I believe that Bitcoin is moving into position to become a reserve asset, a strategic asset. And you will see the protocol bring in more high-level gamers, you know, the central banks and the institutions. So I think that $100,000. Now, the price at which it starts to eclipse fiat money entirely. You know, you're talking 200,000, 220,000. I suggest people start talking in terms of Satoshis. You know, there's what, 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis, I believe.
Yeah, I think there's what, a million Satoshis.
The breakdown, there's a lot of zeros involved, but it's I think it's 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis. So it would be the subset of the 2.1 million Bitcoin. And so we're going to be talking about, and Satoshis are pennies, you know. We got to start talking about Satoshis at a buck, Satoshis at $5 or something like that. I mean, forget about the Bitcoin price, whether it's $3,500 or $100,000. You know, it's like Warren Buffett stock, it's $300,000 a share. But if he had been splitting all the way, it would be at $20 a share. People don't, you know, the price is the last thing to be talking about.
What got you into Bitcoin, right? How did you first learn about it?
Well, when I was in Los Angeles, I started a company called the Hollywood Stock Exchange. And so we had to create virtual securities, the virtual money, and the virtual market making. So I have a patented technology called the virtual specialist technology. And it's really the first patented virtual currency that ever been created. It's part of a virtual trading system with virtual securities. At that time, that's when I know Brock Pierce. Brock Pierce was doing the Digital Entertainment Network, or DEN. At that time. And, you know, Brock was trading on Hollywood Stock Exchange, and Hollywood Stock Exchange was traded wildly, you know, all over Los Angeles. And, you know, then Brock went into mining gaming coins in China and things of this nature. Like, he stuck to his virtual currency path. And so I was already well into virtual currencies and, you know, if I may say, have invented virtual currencies. So when John Matonis came on Kaiser Report and said, okay, let's talk about Bitcoin, he came out of the encryption business, out of Hushmail. He had that product. He then became chairman of Bitcoin Foundation. And so he's laying out the Bitcoin story. And so, you know, I naturally just started to it solved all these problems that I had creating virtual currency. It's like, wow, you know, this is genius, because I know all these problems that we were trying to solve. And the way I solved it was through massive, you know, software to get to the same place. You know, this gets rid of 99% of what I have built into the virtual specialist technology to create something like this, right? So this just actually solves it with the proof of work algorithm. And so that got me going.
It's incredible. So the creator of virtual currency.
I mean, I make that claim, you know, because there's a patent number 5950176. It's a U.S. patent. It was filed in 1996. And it's eventually it was sold to Cantor Fitzgerald on Wall Street. They use it as part of their, derivatives trading platforms. You know, it's ironic because derivatives are a threat to Bitcoin, and a lot of banks that trade derivatives reference my patent in trading derivatives, because they're coming up with essentially a synthetic price based on the underlying technology of that patent. And that's the way Cantor Fitzgerald uses it. They're a huge derivatives trader. And Howard Lutnick, who runs Cantor, you know, he's always threatening to do something in crypto, you know. But, you know, they're a prime broker in the Federal Reserve System, which means they just get free money all day. So he's not incentivized actually to do a stick of work over there at Cantor. He's just a rentier, freeloading bum, as far as I'm concerned. I don't have any sympathy for Howard. If I just put that out there.
I'll leave that alone. But are you one of those guys that's Bitcoin, not blockchain? Do you believe in blockchain at all, or do you think it's just Bitcoin?
There is no such thing as a blockchain without Bitcoin. That's called a spreadsheet. There's nothing. There's no such thing, really. It doesn't exist. There's Bitcoin, and then there's some interesting variations on that theme, but everything else is has a new value. There's nothing in the outside of Bitcoin that's not going to be replicated by Bitcoin. It's just because it took a while for the development cycles to catch up, you know, to move forward. There was no need for Bitcoin Cash or none of that stuff was needed. There's no need for big blocks. There's not. All that stuff was just frustration by the part of a few people that were not happy with the pace at which this technology was going. So they decided to, splinter off and try to compete with it. And And when you try to compete with Bitcoin, you get destroyed. You know, I welcome everyone to try to compete with Bitcoin because I enjoy watching them go down in flames. They get burnt at the stake of their own stupidity. You know, throw another idiot on the bonfire of their vanities. Go ahead, create another Bitcoin. You're going to be burnt to the crisp.
So, you know, with that being said,
I've got a bag of marshmallows. I mean, toasting them over your corpse.
Well, Bitcoin jerk off.
You know, well, just contribute to the protocol and stop being such a narcissistic asshole. Okay, that's my advice. I hope you don't have any altcoin people on this show. You know they're not going to watch.
Yeah, maybe
they'll be upset.
Maybe I'll
get some hate mail. It's not that I don't get hate mail already.
Do you think that outside of a store of value being used as currency, Bitcoin has uses? I mean, rephrase the question, I guess, versus, you know, just blockchain in general, right? Do you think there's other use cases other than just currency for the blockchain, which is Bitcoin?
The short answer is it doesn't need any other use cases. You know, gold is 90% of gold is hoarded. People say, oh, gold, you have uses outside of just hoarding gold, but 90% is hoarded. You can do some in electronics and some jewelry factory or whatever, but it's hoarded. And that's its primary use case. And for Bitcoin's store of value, its primary use case is that it's hard money. You know, as Safe Dean Moose writes in the Bitcoin Standard brilliantly, you know, he makes the case, lays it out. It's the hardest money that's ever been created. Now, having said that, I think that what does hard money offer to somebody? It offers them a way to combat the ravages, you know, the injustices of fiat money. I mean, that's a lot. I mean, what more do you want? I mean, on top of that, you've got all the utility value and the scaling and Lightning Network and all these payments and all these other things are being built on top of the protocol. The scaling and all that stuff can be built. That's all coming. There's a lot of entrepreneurs building all that stuff. You know, I have a venture capital fund that I started in 2013, and it's 90% Bitcoin centric. And we have exchanges in there like Kraken. We have BitPay. We bought when they first started raising money. You know, it's a payment processor.
Sure.
We have Bitso, which is an exchange in Mexico. We have BitPesa in Kenya, right? So they are talking about Africa. This is bringing a population and just loving the fact that they are now bypassing all of the state intermediaries and trading directly back and forth. You know, if you can trade freely person to person without any third-party intermediary, that's the most peaceful thing you could possibly have happen. And that's the way humans are designed. You know, we're not designed to have values dictated from a third party because that third party is incentivized to abuse that position, as they do. And then they create these awful power structures that are lazy. And the laziest thing you can do if you have a country and a lot of central bank money to play with is start wars and open prisons. That's the easiest thing. The prison industry is huge because it's easy. You just pour some concrete in the desert and you go arrest guys for no reason and you just collect the money from the state. That's it, right? Or drop a bomb, you know, make more bombs. It's just easy. They're lazy. That's why we do these things. So you got to get rid of the bums. You know, the Jamie Dimon is a bum. He just collects pennies all day long for being an intermediary, for completely unnecessary. He never worked an honest day in his life.
I could sit here and talk to you all day.
He's a fucking bum! Jamie Dimon. I mean, if I could make that point.
Jamie Dimon.
Yeah.
I could definitely talk to you all day long. I know you have your documentary.
Your sound guy's on the floor writhing in pain right now. I think you might have to call the hospital. Hello?
We'll get to him in a minute. But, you know, we didn't really get a chance to talk about you at all. You know, as far as...
I'm a hologram. I'm a sniper. I'm Satoshi.
So I could talk to you all day long about everything. But, you know, favorite movie, favorite book, you know, just get a couple things before we got to get you back next door. I mean, you got like a minute left. So tell us about you, just like the 60-second overview.
Wow. 60 seconds overview about me.
Like a favorite movie, favorite book, like maybe like the best advice you ever got, advice for other people. We're super successful, so.
Well, I wouldn't say that, really. You know, I think that I started out on Wall Street, basically, in the 80s. And I took that job, basically, because I just needed a job. And I had a bunch of jobs. And I just happened to take that job. And so a lot of people, I think, they try to wait for that perfect job or that perfect opportunity, or they don't want to do things that they don't think they're really, it's not for them per se exactly. But, you know, especially if you're 20 something, and the thing is just to start, you know, put one foot in front of the other and just start. And I guess, like, if I can pass on any wisdom, because I just had my birthday. I just turned 59. So I am pushing the year. So I guess I'm going to get these questions more and more now. How did you make it, you know, past the 80s? And, you know, I learned something when I moved to France. I moved to France once in 1990. I just loved it so much in Paris. And I just moved there. I didn't speak any French. I didn't really know anybody. It just was, I had accumulated, a bunch of cash after being in the Wall Street for a while. But that's all I had, really. But, you know, the ability to be able to be in a foreign country, different language, and to get by, you know, the skill sets you need to do that are, you need to reach down deep and find whatever humility you may have or humbleness that you can muster. Because, I mean, on Wall Street, it's all about having ultra confidence. But that doesn't work if you're in a country that you don't know how to speak the language, you don't really know anybody, because you just get rejected by the population. You really have to be, you know, willing to be humble, right? And I think that's the hardest thing anyone can try to learn in life. And it's something I think everyone struggles with, really. But it's the way to avoid getting into too much trouble. You know, the ego, this is what happened during the crypto run-up in 2016, 2017. The people who were borderline narcissistic became full-blown narcissists and dangers. But on the other hand, the people who were borderline altruistic became almost saintly, like an Andreas Antonopoulos. You know, the Bitcoin has transformed him from being a good guy to being, you know, I don't want to go too far on this, but almost, you know, saintly, in that he is totally dedicated to spreading the gospel of what he sees as this empowering, freeing technology. And there's no way to anticipate this except to have some humility to wake up and understand that, you know, you were probably going to be in a position to learn something today, but you have to be prepared to learn something. That's my thought of the day.
Be prepared to learn something.
Be prepared to learn.
Be humble.
Try to be humble. You know, when you're handsome, smart, rich like me.
There you go.
It's hard to be humble. Beautiful wife. Successful TV show. It's very hard for me to be humble. But I try. No, but I guess that's all the troubles I've had is when I think I know what I'm doing. And I have my confidence is like, I'm so positive about this. And it's like, that's you generally the worst, you know, but
I think you've been right more than you've been wrong, though. So you're doing pretty good.
You know, that's not true because, I mean, if I may add something else to this, you know, the fact is that Babe Ruth struck out more times than he hit home runs. You know, Michael Jordan, I think, missed 55 or 9,000 shots or something astronomical. You know, the best money managers on Wall Street are wrong 70% of the time. You're actually wrong. The successful people are wrong quite often. They're wrong more than they are right, but they try more. They keep going. They just keep going. You know that you're going to be wrong, right? That's where the humility comes in. You're going to be wrong. I'm wrong. But that you can't wait to be right. You can't wait to figure, I'm just going to wait for something to come along that I have more confidence in. That's going to be right. You got to fail. I mean, in the United States, the culture is there's no stigma attached to failure. We actually have the anti-hero, you know, the guy who is, he's heroically bad. You know, the mafia movies, The Godfather, they're heroes, but they can't seem to do anything that, you know, that's law abiding, can they? They're always breaking the law, but yet they're heroic because they keep trying. They see that's the American way. So in Europe, however, If you mess up one time, it's a stigma that you're a loser and it's horrible. You carry around with you like a black cloud is following you. So consequently, people, and particularly in London and in the UK, They don't take any risks whatsoever. They're very risk averse. They're all pincing and they're all very guarded and they're all very gossiping and they're fear based. And the queen might see me. What if the queen sees me and they still have a goddamn queen there? When I moved there, I'm like, the queen's just like something at the wax museum, right? You don't give her any respect. But no, they give her respect. There's like monarchists there. People who actually believe the queen is not just a, you know, shits and farts like everybody else, right? I mean, they actually think this broad has some agency other than just hereditary, you know, lucky semen club, so I may say. I hope I don't offend anyone. Brexit was their ego taking them to a place that is their downfall. When they started Brexit, they thought that, well, the EU will give us a good deal because we're British, right? And the EU is like, you got no leverage. We don't really think much about you. If you want to leave the EU, you can, but it's going to be painful for you. You know, nobody really likes you. Nobody likes British people because they've got this silly queen. But they'll find out, they'll find out the hard way. Nigel Farage is the dangerous man.
So a lot of gems in there. So if you fall off the horse, keep getting back up. And you only have to be right once, like Mark Cuban says, right? So you don't have to be right more than you're wrong. Just be right once.
That's right. You just, very, very just right. Keep going. Keep going. And just keep going. And actually, you're going to make a lot of mistakes.
We all do. Hopefully we learn from them. Don't repeat them, right? So
hopefully.
My favorite movie, favorite book.
Well, give me a decade, because I've been watching movies for decades now. So, like, if you go to the 70s, I would say, big Paul Newman fan with Butch Cassidy and Sting. And I would say probably my favorite movie is The Verdict with Paul Newman. Sidney Lumet is the director, and he's a down-and-out lawyer in Boston who takes on a case that it's a loser case. He's alcoholic, and he's about to be tossed out of the bar.
I get already.
And he battles back, essentially, and wins the case spectacularly in the end. And it's a story about redemption. And this is a guy who, and Paul Newman's genius actor, and it's brilliantly played, brilliantly directed, and the great supporting cast. And it's about redemption. So he overcomes his inner turmoil in the end, and on behalf of his client, who was the victim of malpractice by the hospital that's connected to the church, effectively. So the church comes in and they have a very strong, heavy hand. We're the church. We're right. We have moral rectitude. And
sounds good.
Yeah, he triumphs in the end. So I think that I've seen that movie 20 or 30 times. It's a great film. Matrix, I thought, was transformative in so many ways.
Wachowski sisters. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to them. So they saw the truth, and it had an effect on them.
The red pill.
That's the thing. When you see the truth, it can have an impact on you in deep, deep levels. And then, Matrix 2 and 3, of course, were not as good. But what an unbelievable film. And it resonates in, our industry and our time so much. I talk about movies for a long time.
Sure. What about books, though?
So Safe Games, The Bitcoin Standard. When I was in university, I read a lot of Carl Jung and really got into this idea of synchronicity and the global unconscious and the collective unconscious. Bitcoin and technology in general is heading toward a more reality of a collective unconscious, so that the individual differentiations are going to probably go away at some point, and we're more or less part of a swarm mind. I think humans as individuals, I think that is coming to an end, actually, because the environment doesn't support human life much longer. There's not enough air and water, but collectively, on digitally, on some platform post-humanity, there'll be an extension of who we are. And, Bitcoin is a good currency for that. The fiat money and gold is not going to work in that environment. All thoughts will be monetized. All interactions will be instantaneous. And well, we're going to have the disappearance of things like time. You know, I think ultimately the whole notion of time collapses. We don't have this whole thought of a linear progression. I think we're just going to be completely in the now. And I think psilocybin mushrooms are coming back as well in a big way for therapeutic reasons. You'll see that in the next 24 months. Mushrooms are coming back. I think they're legalized down in Oregon. This is the next wave after legalizing marijuana is mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms. And, you know, this is a gateway into the collective unconscious, you know, which is, I think, powerful. But it doesn't require ego, centricity in any way. You don't need your ego when you're part of the plane of consciousness that extends from, you know, throughout the cosmos.
Talking about ayahuasca?
The thing about ayahuasca is that I don't know a lot about it other than my late friend Matthew Mellon was apparently down in Mexico and keeled over as part of something, you know, with that. You know, I'm basically, I like to commune with nature, basically. Basically, nature has an incredible, vibrant language going on. That always, I mean, in a city like Las Vegas, you're detached.
Sure.
But, you know, when you're in the forest, you know, the forest is
interconnected.
It is totally interconnected. You know, all those roots are all connected. Everything's connected. And it's a very vibrant language that the forest is speaking.
Network.
Right. And it's the photosynthesis is the most genius price discovery mechanism in the world. You know, you're exchanging oxygen for carbon, essentially, and you're doing so frictionlessly within the photosynthetic
mechanism. Exchange.
Right. So those types of frictionless exchanges are the basis of what we call life. So then where does the energy come from? It comes from the Big Bang. We're still riding the surf of the Big Bang. All that energy. People, okay, I can move. I can use my brain to move something. And we need telekinesis. I can do it right now.
Yeah.
You ready? Here I go. Watch. Oh.
There you go.
How do I do that? I use my brain to use this, right? Oh my God. I'm telekinesis. Right? By moving that chair in the same way, we anyone can do it. It's just that we believe we can't. But we can. I mean, why not? I mean, because we're all in the same space, really. That all differentiations in any way are completely artificial. It's all big one. I like what I learned a couple of weeks ago that scientists figured out by taking every color in the universe and coming up with the color of the cosmos, they came up with cosmic latte. Apparently the universe is the color of a latte. This is very valuable information. Because I'm figuring if I'm going to be part of this underground,
I'm going to be
caffeinated. That's the most important thing. I don't mind being part of the collective unconscious. If I can get a good, you know, macchiato, that's fine. I don't care. Go ahead, plug me into the matrix. This macchiato tastes great.
Steak tastes
good. That's what I like. Yeah. That's good.
Well, I can talk to you all day. I know that I got to get you next door. We're already running.
Oh, yeah. My Stacy's already, you know, I'm in trouble now.
I got to get you later, so.
Thanks, Robert.
A pleasure.
All right, Robert. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
See ya.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Huge thanks to Max. I got some mad respect for you, my friend. You know, thanks for coming on and just kind of sharing your thoughts and everything that you do for us, man, for the people. Really appreciate you. And for anybody that hasn't seen him debate Peter Schiff, check that out on YouTube. It is extremely entertaining and educational. And did I mention entertaining? It's awesome. Check it out on YouTube. Peter Schiff debate with Max Kaiser. It's awesome. Just a friendly reminder, Crypto Beetle shows are never financial advice, recommendations, or trading strategies. The views expressed here are solely that of Robert Beetles and his guests. Robert Beetles is the co-founder of the Monarch Wallet, host of Trading View Sessions, Crypto Beetles on YouTube, and on several entities. Robert's opinions here do not reflect that of those entities. Some information shared here may not actually be factual.
These shows are for information and entertainment purposes only. Never invest a single Satoshi or penny in anything without first seeking the counsel and advice of a professional financial advisor. Robert Beatles is not a financial expert or advisor. Investing in anything is super dangerous. You can lose all of your money, so always trade at your own risk. And one last thing before we get into this, please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the family.
Love you. God bless you all, and I'll catch you on the next one.